Accession number 20314, Reel 1.
Jockey White, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in High Wycombe in Buckinghamshire.
Which year was this?
On the 13th of February 1924.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in High Wycombe?
Yes, I was educated at Spring Garden School in High Wycombe.
How old were you when you left there?
14.
So, which year was that?
1938.
Did you get a job?
Yes, I did.
Doing what?
I was an apprentice cabinet maker and carver with Egoms, the furniture people of High Wycombe.
Is that what you were doing when war was declared?
No, I left there to go repairing shot down Wellington bombers, or damaged Wellington bombers, and I did that for about a year and then joined the Royal Air Force.
So you were repairing Wellingtons in the early years of the war?
Yes, it was, yes.
How did you go about repairing Wellingtons?
We inserted geodetic items into the airframes, and then they were cut, as you know, they were covered in canvas, and we then covered them over in canvas, and off they went flying again. They had been damaged during air raid operations over Germany.
What kind of geodetic items were these?
It was the Barnes-Wallis geodetic construction of the Wellington bomber. Like that.
Like a framework?
Framework, yes.
Were there any problems doing that job?
The only problem, of course, was the aluminium. It was an aluminium construction, and once you had repaired these aircraft airframes, all the aluminium had to be treated with a special chemical to make sure that it was still wouldn't rot away again. There was quite a lot of problems, but they were overcome.
Was it a well-paid job?
Not really, no.
And so what tools would you have to do the job?
The usual engineering tools, drills, grinding tools, etc. And then, of course, when I was in the airframe part of it, repairing the airframe part of it, and then we had the people who covered the canvas over the airframe after we'd repaired it.
So you'd gone from woodworking to metalworking?
Yes, actually, my first experiences with working with aeroplanes was when I was at GOMS. We made the main spar for the Mosquito fighter bomber, which of course was made out of wood. So whilst I was at GOMS, I had an interest in aeroplanes, and then this opportunity arose for this other job to come up, and I went repairing them.
The main spar?
The main wing spar. Was made of wood, made of laminated wood.
And what precisely did you do on that main spar?
Yeah, we're using my apprenticeship technique and what I've been trained to do working with wood. It was the actual manufacturing of the actual main spar, planing it and shaping it and making it fit to the jig that had been supplied for us at GOMS.
Were there any problems with that job?
No, not really, no. It's just working with wood, which I was very much used to.
Which job did you prefer, the job on the Mosquitoes or the Whimpers?
On the Mosquito, I think, was preferable, because it was working with wood, whereas on the Wimpy, it was working with metal.
What was the name of the firm? GOMS?
GOMS. The G-Plan people of High Wycombe.
How do you spell GOMS?
G-O-M-M-E.
Did you hear Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes, I did. In fact, very much so, because I was at work at the time, and within a matter of a few hours of the declaration, we were evacuated from the factory to nearby fields because an air raid was expected. On the first day of the war, an air raid was expected, and we were evacuated by the hooter on the firm blowing three blasts, and we all evacuated the factory, went up into nearby fields. Remember that very well.
How did you feel about the news?
As a youngster, I suppose, quite excited.
Didn't you feel dismayed in any way?
No, I don't think so, to be honest, no.
And when you did the job on the Wellingtons, was the work brought to you?
It was brought to me, brought to the factory I was working for then.
Were you in any bombing of England?
Yes. Shortly after I joined the Royal Air Force, I went to Lord's Cricket Ground, to the Aircrew Recruitment Centre, and whilst there, of course, I was in the centre of some of the bombing of London. So I did experience a little bit of it there. Before that, of course, when I was quite a lot younger, I experienced the being on the edge of it. In High Wycombe, you could see when the Germans were bombing London, you could see the conflagrations and you could actually hear some of it before I joined the Royal Air Force. What gave me the incentive to join the Royal Air Force, I think, was the actual working on the Mosquito. It gave me a feeling that I wanted to get some of the action. Perhaps it would have been as well if I'd have stayed repairing them than joining up and flying them.
And when did you join the Air Force?
I joined the Royal Air Force on the 17th of May 1943.
How did it come about?
I volunteered for flying duties and went to Oxford to universities in Oxford, and there I took various aptitude tests and was accepted for aircrew duties.
How did you feel about that, going into aircrew?
Very excited.
Where did you do the training at first?
Initially after St John's Wood, Lord's Cricket Ground at St John's Wood, I went to Herefordshire, yes, to a place called Madley, the radio school in Madley, near to Hereford itself, and did the training there.
What was that like?
Reasonably easy. I took to Morse very, very quickly. I took to the Morse code very quickly, and the rest of it came naturally to keeping your radio sets in working condition, and that I took to it quite naturally.
So what particular job were you being trained for?
As a radio operator on the aircraft.
Which other places did you go to for training?
I went to a place called Llandyrog, near to Mount Snowdon in North Wales. Then I went to Castle Donnington and Wimeswold in Lincolnshire, and it was at Wimeswold where we actually crewed up. You went to the Royal Air Force Station at Wimeswold as individuals, and within a matter of a few days you all got together, the pilots, the bomb aimers, the navigators, the gunners, engineers, etc., all got together, and they left it completely to the individual. There was no sort of, oh, this one or that one or that one. They left it completely to the individual to crew up together. And without any doubt, we made a good selection between us because we became a very happy, integrated crew.
Any incidents that happened to you during the training?
Yes. We were training from a place called Sandtoft, near Doncaster, which was nicknamed Prangtoft. And we took off in a Halifax on a training flight. And over High Wycombe, would you believe, all the four engines stopped. What had happened is that there had been a lack of fuel in the tanks, and all of the engines stopped, and my flight engineer managed to switch tanks very quickly and got them all working again. It was a bit of a hairy do, because there I was over High Wycombe, very close to my home, with all four engines stopped.
This is in a Halifax?
On the Halifax, yeah. Then from Castle Donington, I went to Sandtoft, and then to Lindholm, where it was the Lancaster Finishing School, Lindholm, where we converted from Halifax's to Lancaster's. And from there, I went on to the squadron. I joined the 166 squadron at Kirmington, near Grimsby.
Which squadron was that?
166.
What did you feel about the quality of training in the RAF then?
I felt it was very good. I felt it equipped us to do the job for which we had volunteered. We were all volunteers.
What impression did the unit make on you at first?
At the time there was deep snow, so it didn't make much of an impression. So, of course, we were grounded for a while. We eventually did a few familiarisation flights on the Lancaster. My crew, there were three Canadians, three Royal Canadian Air Force officers. There was Bud Churchwood, the pilot, Chock Goddard, the bomb aimer, Lefty Etherington, the navigator. I was the radio operator. Ted Hull from Romford was the flight engineer. Jack Goldstein from Stamford Hill in London, was the mid-upper gunner. And Bob Green from Barnsley in Yorkshire was the rear gunner. And we all trained together. We had a good training sessions. And then on the 1st of February 1945, we did our first operational trip. This was to Mannheim, to bomb Mannheim, and we took off at about 5 o'clock. We went to Mannheim and hopefully bombed the target, and we landed back at base after about 7 hours. And we thought at the time, this is our first trip, if all the others are going to be like this, it's a piece of cake. The next one I did was to Stettin, which was right up in the north of Germany, near Poland, near the Polish border. And that was a very, very dicey trip. We flew straight across the North Sea at 200 feet and then climbed to do the bombing trip. And then, because there was a very bad weather front, we had to keep below this weather front, climbed to do the bombing trip of Stettin, and then came back down again to get below the front to come back home. But we did it okay. It was a bit dicey.
What was the opposition like of German cities back then?
Sometimes it was quite heavy. Others, there were no anti-aircraft fire at all. There was no opposition at all, really.
Do you remember the next trip?
Let me have.
Actually, looking at your logbook, it says your second op was to Wiesbaden.
Yes, that's right.
And your fourth op was to Stettin.
Yes.
So which was the one where you had the weather problem?
The fourth op, when we went to Stettin.
Any of these other operations that stick out in your mind before you were shot down?
Yes, very much so. The fifth op I did was to Dresden, which was on my 21st birthday. The 13th of February 1945.
What happened?
Well, this is a very long trip. We went to Dresden, which was about 980 miles from the UK, to support the the Red Army advance into Germany, we arrived there after about 4.5 hours flying, and we then got onto the bombing run where it had to be straight and level for 7 miles. We approached the target, and just after the bombs had been released into the inferno underneath, there was an almighty crash in the front of the aircraft, and bits of metal and documents flew all over the place. We had been hit right on the nose of the aircraft by a German anti-aircraft shell, which blew part of the nose off the aircraft. The shrapnel from the shell also made lots of holes in the aircraft and left his navigational charts were blown out of these holes. My pilot, Bud, always instructed me, the radio operator, to observe what was going on around us from the astral dome, which is above the, this is on the top of the aircraft. And as the nose got blown off the aircraft, Bud swerved off course. And on looking up, I saw a 4,000-pound cookie, 4,000-pound bomb, falling from an aircraft Lancaster up right above us. And I was very pleased to see it fall between the main wing and the rear wing. Had that hit us, I wouldn't be talking to you now. But I'm afraid it was a bit, my joy was short-lived, because the incendiaries from this same aircraft started falling onto us. Some of them hit the propellers on the starboard side, and some then penetrated the fuselage. And I saw there were four fires inside the aircraft. There was only one thing for me to do, was to put them out, because I wasn't very busy. I was just the radio operator, not very busy as far as flying the aircraft was concerned. So I unclipped my oxygen mask and my communication cords. I told Bud what I was going to do, Bud the pilot, what I was going to do, and he approved it. And I went down the aircraft without oxygen. I carried a fire extinguisher with me and put the two of the incendiaries out with this fire extinguisher. There were still two incendiary bombs burning in the aircraft, and I realised that the only way I was going to get them out of the aircraft was to kick them into a plastic bubble we had underneath us, which housed the H2S radar ground scanning system. And I did this. I kicked them into this bulge, and they burned through the plastic and fell away. And then I was left in complete darkness, and was obviously disorientated, and I passed out through lack of oxygen. I hadn't taken a portable oxygen thing with me. I just grabbed the fire extinguisher. And the next thing I remember is Ted, the flight engineer, holding an oxygen mask over my face and trying to get me onto the rest bed, a canvas rest bed, which was in the Lancaster. He managed to get me onto the bed, and then he had a first aid kit with him, and he treated some burns, some magnesium burns that I'd incurred when I was kicking these bombs out of the aircraft. And I also had burns on my hands and on my legs, but Ted was very good, and he treated me for them. Then, of course, the question arose of getting the Lank back from Dresden to the base at Kirmington, 980 miles away. We had very little power on the two starboard engines. We had holes all over the aircraft, and we had but fortunately my radio was still working, and we had a crew chat, and it was decided that Bud, the pilot, Ted, the flight engineer, and Chock, the bomb aimer, would concentrate on keeping the aircraft flying in a straightish line because it was trying to pull round to the left all the time. With the two port engines, it was trying to pull round to the left all the time. With the starboard engines, two starboard engines giving very little power, it was trying to pull off. It was decided that the rear gunner and the mid-upper gunner would keep very sharp lookout for any further problems. And it was Lefty, the navigator, and myself to try and get it back to base. Fortunately, my radio was still working properly, and I obtained a fix on the radio to which would be give us directions back to the UK. The direction finding loop, which was a loop consisting of a series of wires, was also working, and from that we get a further confirmation of the course back to base. But before very long, we were all getting very very cold with the draft through the aircraft, and we had to descend to 10,000 feet or below. And we were still completely on our own, because by then all the other aircraft surrounding us had vanished. And at that height, of course, you were very susceptible to anti-aircraft fire. I asked Bud for permission to break radio silence, which is a thing only done in extreme emergencies, and he gave permission, and I broke radio silence, and using a Morse code and a coded message to base, I was able to get in touch with base, and we gave us a course to steer. We followed these courses between Lefty and I, we managed to navigate it back on these courses. And then there was a discussion of should we land at one of the emergency drones specifically set aside for this purpose on the east coast of England. There was one at Manston, one at Woodbridge, and one at Carnaby. But we wanted to get our aircraft back to base, and we eventually got it back to base. As we landed, most of the parts that had been damaged fell off the aircraft, and poor old B. Baker was rendered completely unserviceable. But as we got back to base, Bud landed it, and then we taxied into our dispersal point, and a wonderful piece of flying on behalf of every one of the crew. And when we got back to dispersal, they had to thaw Bud, Ted, and Chock. They had to thaw them out before they could actually move them. It was so cold with this wind coming through the aircraft. We landed back 9¾ hours after taking off, so it was nearly 7 o'clock in the morning when we landed back. And we were given our usual tots of rum and went to bed. And thinking, well, that's us, our aircraft is unserviceable, and so we've done a long trip. We didn't get into bed until 8 o'clock in the morning. But the next night, the 14th of February, the alarm went up. We were briefed for another trip to a place called Chemnitz in Germany, which is quite near to Dresden. Fortunately, that was another 9-hour flight, but fortunately it went without any problems.
But what about your burns?
My burns were treated by the doctor on the base. They weren't as severe as they appeared to be at first, but they were treated. I still went flying the next night.
Did this Dresden raid, from your point of view, seem to be any different from the others?
Any different? It can only be described in the book, the Dresden, the Devil's Inferno. It is a very apt description of it. It was an absolute inferno. It was a terrible raid. But people say to me when I mention Dresden raid, I think anything like that was justified because it was war, and war is war. On reflection, I have been back to Dresden since, and on reflection, now, I would say it would be completely unjustified to do it now.
But it did actually appear different from the air to the other air you're on.
Oh yes, it was terrible because there was an almighty explosion, and it blew. We were at 20,000 feet, and it blew us all over the place. It was a terrible explosion.
But what was happening on the ground seemed to be different.
This absolute conflagration. It was a firestorm on the ground. I'd done a couple of other bombing raids, but nothing like this Dresden. And in fact, I don't think all the other bombing raids I did after Dresden was anything like that. It was terrible.
So you've got up to the Chemnitz raid. Any other raids that stick out in your mind before the one on which you were shot down?
No. There was in Forsheim, which was the 9th raid. We were attacked by a German fighter, and Bob, the rear gunner, thinks he shot it down, but he wasn't sure. But other than that, the other raids before the Nuremberg raid were all routine, if those raids could be described as routine.
You told me that Avi Jones visited you during the war. Can you tell me under what circumstances you met him?
The only thing I can think of is we had visits from various people. And including security advice, etc. And that's the only thing I can think of. I certainly have a book signed by R.V. Jones. And the only thing I can think of is that he must have come onto the squadron. He certainly wasn't after I repatriated him. He must have come onto the squadron to give us a talk on security and evading capture, etc. That's the only thing I can think of. I've certainly got a book signed by him.
Now, you also had raids on Dessau, Kassel and Herne.
Herne, yes.
Herne, before, and also daylight raids on Essen and Dortmund.
That's right, yes.
Any memories of those?
Not really. The memories really are how easy the daylight raids were, because we were then escorted by by American Mustang fighters and Spitfires, and it was very assuring to us to look out and see these Spitfires and Mustangs flying alongside us, knowing that if we were attacked again by German fighters, they were there for our protection. Very little of any note took place on those other raids. They were quite routine.
Now, the raid on which you were shot down, 16th of March 1945, please, if you can take me through that step by step, please.
Yes. 16th of March 1945, we were briefed to go to Nuremberg. The briefing really went like this. You were warned to be in the briefing room, which was situated on the aerodrome, and you had to identify yourself personally by your dog tags to the police corporal who was on duty at the briefing room door. You went into the briefing room where all the other crews were being similarly briefed. And behind the curtains was the target for that night. Wing Commander Vivian, the CO of the squadron, came in and the curtains were drawn aside. And we saw that the target was Nuremberg. And all of us, without exception, accepted that Nuremberg was the unlucky target for the 166 squadron. Each and every time prior to this that my squadron had been to Nuremberg, we lost 3 aircraft, a total of 21 men. The CO gave his pep talk, and the various section leaders, the gunnery section, the wireless section, gave their various talks on various codes, etc. And the briefing was to take off at 5 5 p.m. So.